From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
I'm Emily Rooney. This is Boston Public Radio. Well, the buzz over the weekend was, of course, all about the deal-making ahead of the year-end budget crunch. And you don't need to be an insider to know President Obama and House Speaker John Boehner met yesterday. But both sides are mum on what sort of horses were being traded. As of this morning, we're still at an impasse. Meanwhile, late Friday, the Supreme Court agreed to take up two gay marriage issues. That was bound to happen. That's going to be setting up a landmark ruling sometime in 2013. We'll talk about that. And, of course, we are still waiting for a verdict in the Tim Cahill corruption case. A jury has had the case since last Tuesday. Once again, it's politics as usual. I'm joined here in the studio by Boston Globe columnist Jeff Jacoby and David Kravitz, who's a writer for Blue Mass Group. Welcome to both of you.
Hi, Emily.
I'm beginning to feel like this Cahill thing could be a hung jury. I mean, it's 6 days. I mean, I know it's complicated to a point, but it didn't seem that complicated.
I don't know. I tend to come down on the side of those who think that this was a case of making something criminal that didn't quite deserve that label. I understand all the arguments.
Yeah, struggling with that.
But I, you know, when you see people as Bill Weld, of all people, you know, coming in to suggest that this might have been a case of criminalizing something that's really a political decision. Maybe the jury's wrestling with the same thing.
I tend to agree with that. I think this was probably not a great case. My view, you know, I'm no prosecutor, but I kind of question whether this case really should have been brought. So I agree with Weld and with you, Jeff, and one wonders whether the jury isn't struggling.
You
with
wonder
whether they really want to put somebody in prison for doing something
that politicians always do.
You look at Tim Cahill sitting in court there with his clean cut, you know, look and the blonde hair and the beautiful wife and the five daughters. You're thinking, really? I got to put this guy in jail?
Really
for why is this really? I mean, I understand the argument. There were the National Republican Governors Association were advertising against him. He had this money to spend. But how is this different from, a U.S. senator campaigning someplace where he can announce or she can announce that there's going to be a government contract issued that day and, as it were, taking credit for it? How is it different from a president?
Well, taking money that's designated for one thing and using it for another.
Right,
they're calling it a misappropriation.
But if the law gives the treasurer or gave the treasurer the right to spend $1.8 million placing ads to promote a state lottery – you know, something that I personally am strongly opposed to, just
I'm
as a matter
with
of
you,
policy.
Me too.
But if you're going to give an elected official that much money and say go advertise it, shouldn't we expect that that among the considerations that will come up will be how can I spend this money to make it most politically advantageous?
And the fact is, as you say, the treasurer has a budget to advertise the lottery. He is expected to do that, and the entire state government wants him to sell as many lottery tickets as he can. When the Republican Governors Association came in and started attacking him, and specifically attacking his management of the lottery, it seems to me there is a plausible argument where he can say, look, they were attacking the management of the lottery. It was a justified expense for me to bolster, to run ads that say, no, the lottery is managed very well. And yes, that happens to help his campaign. And so, if Cahill did anything wrong, he has a bad email trail.
Yeah, I was going to say, he's got this email trail of staffers reaching, spanning the campaign to the treasurer's office and back. And, as anybody knows, if you're running for office, you're not supposed to commingle funds, people, ideas, exchanges between people who are running your political office and people who are running your political campaign. So there's a clear, set of emails that shows that they did do that.
And yet even that don't commingle rule is so often observed, more in the breach than anything else. The idea that if you're David Plouffe, you're not going to be actually thinking about the political implications of everything that you do, whether you're on the White House payroll or not on the White House payroll. It always strikes me as this is what happens when, government gets bigger and politicians get lots of official money to spend. They're always going to spend it with their political interests.
One could see some sort of financial penalty for Cahill.
Yeah,
if
I would
he
think.
Did what
I
he's accused
think.
Of. But the notion that what he did is worthy of sending him to prison honestly strikes me as crazy.
I know, but I mean, you know darn well that's what the prosecution wants, which seems –
That's
you
right.
Know. And there was a piece in the Globe over the weekend, actually, that Glenn Johnson did that sort of – the headline didn't really match the piece. You know, he was talking about that the headline said something – a test for cochlear or something like that, that this particular case was going to be a test case. It didn't really match up because he was just sort of speculating on what the various scenarios could be. I'm not so sure this is a big test case.
No, I don't think it hurts a prosecutor. I mean, unless it seems to be really malicious, which I don't think it was in this case. There's certainly a plausible legal argument to be made. I don't find it very convincing. Clearly, you know, David and I aren't the only ones who don't find it convincing. No. But that somehow this comes back to bite Coakley as though she did something – you know, that she
deserves
to be punished
for?
I don't see that.
I mean, if he is acquitted, if it's a clean acquittal, then, you know, that's always bad for a prosecutor when they bring a big, high-profile case against somebody and it ends up
failing.
But
we can both agree this doesn't rise to the level of dissing voters, you know, and the idea of shaking hands outside Fenway Park. Now, that's a serious
No, that was bad, yeah. So wait a second.
This is just politics as usual.
Does Cahill qualify for any kind of remuneration? I mean, he's really been – he didn't have any money to begin with. And he's, you know, got this high-profile defense attorney and everything. Would he qualify if he's acquitted to have his legal fees paid? Anybody know?
Not that I know.
By whom? Who would
state.
Pay it?
No, I mean, unless you can I don't think so. I mean, you know, it's not like
that
it
was
just
seems like
you
get wiped out financially, you know, for something that you're eventually acquitted of that when the state brings the prosecution.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, in any criminal case, that's the situation. The state is always bringing the
at least in this country. I don't know what in countries like England where they have a loser pays rule for civil. You know, for tort.
Yeah, exactly. You
know, well, what happens in criminal prosecutions if the state sues, prosecutes an official and the official is acquitted? Does this in England, do they
I don't know. I can't follow their court system. It's
not as far as
it's so
as
much
I know,
more
but,
honest than ours. I can't really follow it. You know? They don't allow people to try the case before it goes to court. I just don't understand that. It's like we do here in America. Just the media. All right. Talking to David Kravitz from the Blue Mass Group and Jeff Jacoby, Boston Globe columnist. So I guess we got to give some time here to the fiscal cliff. I heard actually Cokie Roberts this morning on NPR, which actually the greatest little breakdown of who's affected by what, that I actually tried to print it off and I couldn't do it. But I mean, clearly there is going to be a fairly dramatic impact on everybody. I mean, everybody's going to either end up paying a little bit more taxes or they're going to get less. And it looks finally like, I'll let you speak to this, Jeff, that the Republicans are kind of agreeing at least to the top 2%, you know, raising the taxes on the top 2%.
Well, they certainly seem to be setting off a lot of signals that, you know, that don't suggest stalwartness and standing their grounds and digging in their heels. I think tactically, this is not the smartest thing that they could be doing. Republicans and conservatives haven't traditionally opposed increases in tax rates just for the hell of it. They've done it because they thought that there was a serious economic harm that could flow from it. If that case was true 6 months ago, that case is still true now. So I'm not quite sure why Republicans think they're going to gain from negotiating with themselves quite as much. And besides, you know, I'll dissent at least a little bit from the conventional wisdom that says, well, Obama won the election, therefore he's holding all the cards. He's not holding all
no,
the cards.
He's not.
The president can't keep taxes from – can't keep the fiscal cliff, you know, from being – from becoming real if he doesn't get the House of Representatives to pass legislation changing it. Meanwhile, the you know Boehner and the House Republicans you know can't accomplish any kind of you know prevent you know rates from going where they want it to go or don't want it to go without getting the president to sign off on it. So both sides have got cards to hold. It just doesn't seem to me that this is the kind
Does
of all or nothing that it's been described as.
For this lame duck Congress, you know, push off the deadline. I mean, that would be really tedious, but then wait until after the beginning of the year to resolve this?
You mean go over the cliff,
yeah.
As I said?
Yeah.
I think there's a possibility that will happen. But, you know, who knows? It's just such utter speculation at this point. And I do think it's very likely that if there is a deal to be made, it will be made as the clock, you know, ticks down in the very last couple of days.
Well, when does Congress go on break? Isn't it this coming Friday or is it next Friday? I think it's this Friday.
I think I've seen that the legislative calendar requires anything that's going to be passed by December 15th.
Yeah,
is that what it was?
Because they have to actually write the law, which somebody has to actually physically write it. Then it has to be read. you have to give 48 hours notice to all members of Congress, I think, to have actually have some kind of a hard copy of this thing to read it. And then it has to be passed. So I think you're right. I believe it's this Friday.
You know, it's not as though come December 31st, assuming, you know, the Mayans haven't preempted all of this on December 21st. It's not as though come, it's not as though come December 31st, life as we know it is completely different. There will be changes in the tax code, but those changes can certainly be undone in the weeks that follow. I think Krauthammer, somebody suggested over the week, Charles Krauthammer suggested over the weekend that since the Congress is sworn in several weeks before inauguration, you know, a new Congress will come in. They can always pass, you know, they can pass a bill doing whatever they want, you know, the tax rates to do. Have it waiting for the president when, you know, after the inauguration. And
which is very likely because it's, you know, there are more moderates in the House anyway come January than there are now. So it's very possible.
Yeah, I just can't stand
this discussion that much longer.
Right. No, I think that's a pretty plausible way that this would go is that we get to the end of the year, nothing is done, and therefore the marginal tax rates on everybody go up. But that doesn't have any immediate impact. That affects, you know, how much you will have to pay in tax year 2012.
April.
But exactly, a year from next April. And so it's quite easy for the Congress then, particularly the new Congress, which comes in on the 3rd or the 4th of the month, something like that, to pass a bill that says, you know, retroactive to January 1st, the bottom 98% of taxpayers will continue to pay what they've been paying all along. The rate goes up on the top 2%, and maybe we extend the payroll tax cut. Maybe we don't. I don't know. And that's it. And then the president will sign that bill very happily whenever it comes to him. Whether it's before or after Inauguration Day, it doesn't make any sense.
You know, I'll offer one other dissent on something else, this idea that somehow it's Republicans who have got the most to lose here. I wonder if whatever happens, you know, on January 1st or December 31st takes place, if it's perceived as everybody's tax rates going up and somehow this becomes, you know, a general cause for consternation – it seems to me that Democrats pretty much hold the monopoly on the party seen as the party of higher taxes. Mm. And Republicans have pretty much got a pretty clear brand, whatever you might think of that brand, as the party that wants to resist raising taxes. If there's going to be a lot of national anger out there because tax rates go up, I don't think that that's something that redounds necessarily to the disadvantage of Republicans. I think Democrats have a lot to lose as well, which is why you're not seeing all Democrats in Congress, you know, marching in lockstep behind Obama on this.
Well, the problem with
Schumer,
that is,
for example, he's saying that, you know, tax rates on the rich, that's only people who make $1 million and more. It's not as though Democrats are marching together.
But there's hidden taxes. I mean, if you take away entitlements in one form or other from certain groups of people, they'll get it back in another way. Which means that somebody's going to cover that off. I mean, it's not like people are going to go without, whether it's the health care coverage or, you know, so whatever it is, they're going to get it another way. No?
In, you know, in all of our careers, how many times have we seen, you know, cliffs being approached or brinksmanship, you know, being played out? And one way or another, it always ends the way they always do, which is some kind of political deal is worked out.
No one notices in the end. They look at their page stub and they go, I don't notice any
difference. The bigger deal, you know, for all of the talk about tax rates, which seems to be what everybody wants to talk about, I do think the bigger deal is this question of whether the sequestration cuts are allowed to take effect. I believe – you know, I wish I had my facts totally straight, but I believe that's supposed to happen at the same time.
Yeah, exactly
January
the same
1st.
Time. Exactly the same time.
And so if they're not able to come to a deal to avert those cuts, those actually really will have are more likely to have an immediate impact than the tax rates are, because then you have, you know, very dramatic cuts in spending on defense programs and on non-defense programs. And that's going to affect people's jobs. You know, and so that is a really big – that's actually a bigger deal, I think, and ought to be dealt with.
We talk about this cliff and the sequestration and all the rest of it as though it's some kind of overarching natural phenomenon. You know, it's some kind of climate change that human beings had nothing to do with, you know, that no individual – Congress passed this thing.
Yeah.
It's only happening
did.
Because a majority of the House and majority of the Senate passed laws to make it happen.
Yeah.
If we really want to blame anybody, let's blame the people that we elected and put in office.
Right. That absolutely fair point.
Talking to Jeff Jacoby from the Boston Globe and David Kravitz from Blue Mass Group, we do have just a little bit of breaking news here. When I first saw this come up, I was afraid that the whole trial was going to be dismissed. But a judge in the retrial of Dwayne Moore charged in that horrible murder of four people in Mattapan in September of 2010. The judge has let one juror go. Apparently this juror was doing research, whatever that means, probably going on a computer or something like that. The good news is that the judge has appointed an alternate and the trial will resume, the deliberations will resume. That thing just has to come to some kind of a conclusion for the community involved. So anyway, I don't want to get into a whole discussion about that because you know what I really want to talk to Jeff Jacoby about?
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
I'm in trouble now.
You know darn well what it is. All right. SCOTUS, Supreme Court of the United States, taking up two gay marriage suits. This was just inevitable. It was a matter of when. So there's two. One case, of course, is the gay marriage law that was struck down in California. That always surprised me that it was struck down in California. That was at least 2 years ago, maybe three now. And the other one is just the whole Defense of Marriage Act in itself. Can married couples, same-sex married couples, be denied federal benefits? So there's a very good – these are both constitutional issues. Supreme Court is going to be looking at that. Even with a conservative court, I got to believe that both of these are going to come down on the in favor of gay marriage.
It may. Mr. Dooley said a long time ago the Supreme Court follows the election
returns.
You're not
a big proponent of this. Let's just get that on the record.
I personally am not a proponent of same-sex marriage, and I've written plenty of columns over the years opposing it. On the other hand, I wrote a column after Election Day saying that in a democracy, thorny political issues should be decided politically. And it was
because you don't like something doesn't mean it can't be legal. That's the way I feel about boxing.
Right. And just because you want something to be regarded as a civil right doesn't mean it automatically is a civil right
exactly.
Until the people come to that conclusion. Right. So I've argued all along that these are things that should be worked out in the political realm. I wasn't happy when the SJC did it. I never thought this should be something that was imposed by governors from above.
You thought
or
it should be a vote by the people?
This should be worked out in the political system. Whether that means in plebiscites, referenda, or whether it means in legislatures, as they've done now.
Because if you put it to a popular vote, people never want to vote for – they never want to give anybody else the same rights they have.
But actually, that's in the last election, what we saw, for the first time was several states a couple of them adopting same-sex marriage.
The first time in Massachusetts, the first time that – they probably never would have passed.
I have no idea. I don't actually remember whether there was polling around the time of the Goodrich decision in 2004. But certainly it would, if you put it on the vote now in Massachusetts, certainly it would pass easily.
Yeah.
But the point is that in other states, and this was the first time this happened in the 2012 election cycle, gay marriage won in several states.
It was adopted in several states. Washington State, in Maine, in Minnesota, and what was the – there was a fourth state as well.
Maryland.
Maryland.
Right.
And the Minnesota case was rejecting one of these,
traditional
only man
defenses.
And woman
right.
amendments. The others were actually adopting same-sex
that's
marriage
right.
as a law
and,
in their state.
People who share my view on the issue itself may well end up on the losing end of it. But I still think it's just healthier in general for us not to do, for example, what happened with abortion and Roe v. Wade.
Yes.
Where all these decades later, because the Supreme Court basically yanked the plug and pulled an unresolved issue out of the political realm, we're still fighting about it.
I was going to make that comparison.
Issue.
We will never. This is life and death is different from, civil rights. And I got to ask you though, honestly, Jeff. My guess is, I don't want to project on you, that you've softened a little bit on this.
I oppose same-sex marriage as firmly
as much
as
you ever did.
But
really?
But there are a lot of things that I oppose that I'm not a dictator. I don't get my way in it. I am perfectly happy to keep making the argument and will keep making the argument that I don't think that it's something that's good for society or something that the state should encourage. At the same time, I recognize that populations make different decisions on some things. From the decisions that I would make. To take a different kind of analogy, who would have thought – this is something I'm thinking about writing for later this week. So a completely different realm, but just as an example, who would have thought that Michigan, perhaps the most heavily unionized state in the country, would be on the verge of passing a right-to-work law?
Right to work,
and,
which basically says bust the unions.
Or it says give workers a freedom to make decisions for themselves. Does that mean that people have strong feelings one way or the other, should therefore, totally disregard what's said on the other side? Or do you figure you live in a democracy, there will always be people who, strongly feel one way about things that you feel the other way on. And if we want to be able to live together, and continue to have freedoms and decide things without having it imposed on us dictatorially, then sometimes you recognize you've lost and you move on.
I mean, this is going to be ancient history.
By the way, I also believe in pendulums. I think that just because a pendulum moves in one direction, is no reason to think that you know, in time.
Well, once this pendulum hits the side of the clock, that's going to be it. You know, we're going to have gay marriage. It's going to be legal everywhere. Bingo, the end of it. Unlike what you just said a second ago, abortion is never going to end as a debate. I believe that.
Yeah, if the polling is to be believed, and I'm generally a believer that good polling should be believed because it's usually works
right.
Pretty well. as you say, gay marriage will cease to be an issue over a couple of generations because if you look at the breakdown in ages, you look at how people over a certain age and under a certain age feel about gay marriage, the numbers are just incredibly stark, and it's true in all areas of the country. More so in some areas than others probably, but still, you know, this is an issue that, you know, whatever happens this year in the Supreme Court and over the next couple of years in various states, state legislatures as time goes along, I really do believe that over the next several decades, this issue is going to change quite dramatically.
I mean, you're right. People have really, really softened on this. The latest Politico George Washington University survey, 40% approve. You know, flat out gay marriage, equal rights for same-sex couples. 30% just support civil unions. So that's a softening too. It's like a lot of people didn't support civil unions. It's like they're getting there. They're halfway. And 24% just disapprove altogether. And it crosses generations, ethnic, race, religious, everything.
It's worth remembering the Defense of Marriage Act was not some kind of, you know, crazy right-wing ultra-religious plot that was pushed through. It was passed by overwhelming majorities in both houses of Congress. It was signed into law by President Clinton, who vocally supported it. This was not something that was happening way off on the fringes of society. And I'll actually be curious to see if the Supreme Court does strike it down, what theory it will use to do so. The Defense of Marriage Act essentially says marriage, a term that's often used in federal statutes, has to have a meaning. That meaning never used to be controversial before. Now that it's become controversial, we, the Congress, will define what it means for purposes of federal law. At the same time, it left each state free to make its own decision about what marriage would mean for purposes of that state's law. And it seemed at the time like a very reasonable and respectful way of dealing with a difficult issue. If public opinion on the subject has changed now, you know, clearly Bill Clinton would no longer sign it if he were president. That may get reflected in the way in the decision that the court comes to. But I'll still be interested to know what will the court do about this question of when there's a term that federal law uses, a term that needs to be defined, marriage, who gets to decide what that term means?
Well, there's a couple things to say about that. One is that I think the very point that you make of how sort of almost, you know, arguably non-controversial DOMA was in the 1990s when Bill Clinton, of all people, signed it, shows how dramatically the country has shifted in only 20 years because there are a lot of people who supported that law at the time, including Clinton and including a lot of Democrats in Congress who regret it now.
Yeah, he regretted Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then another point is that, you know, the definition of marriage across the states has never been entirely uniform. Some people, you know, you can get married in some states and you can't get married in other states. The same two people can get married in some states but can't get married in other states because of differences in residency requirements, differences in how closely you can be related. That varies from state to state. And so some marriages
– Or age of consent.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So some marriages are legal in some states and not legal in other states, even before the whole gay marriage issue became so prominent. And federal law in the past had always been content to say, we're not going to worry about that. If it's okay with you in the state that you got married, then it's okay with us,
okay,
and we'll
give
you the federal benefits. So the question is now, when we introduce gay marriage into the equation, why did the rules change so suddenly, and is it okay that they did?
That's You're a lawyer, right, David?
Yes.
All right. So this won't probably even come down until October of 2014. That's my understanding.
No, it'll be before that.
October 2013.
If they argue with this
– Yeah, they're expecting it to argue in March of 2013.
You'll have a decision
They'll
in
come
June.
Down
October.
In June
of my guess it'll be the
June.
Last decision okay. handed down by the Supreme
it'll be
Court.
June of 13.
What happens in all the states that currently don't allow gay marriage? Because a federal ruling doesn't necessarily supersede that.
Well, this is the big question.
What are the 41 states?
What does the Supreme Court decide and how do they decide it? And there's actually a lot of interesting wrinkles in what they've done. So they took two cases, as you said. Yeah. One is the Defense of Marriage Act case. The other is the California case. If they went as pro-gay marriage as they possibly could go, they would say in the California case, a state cannot discriminate against gay couples, and if you allow straight couples to get married, you have to allow gay couples.
So that would apply to every state,
and that would apply to every state, and it would basically immediately legalize gay marriage across the country. That would be the most broad rule that they could possibly do. They could not do that. They could rule the other way in the California case and say if a state chooses to say only straight couples, then they're okay with that. But they could also say in the Defense of Marriage Act case, if a gay couple can get married in a state, the federal government has to recognize those benefits.
Got
so
it.
They could
Got
split
it. So
the decision.
Which could happen.
Right.
Yeah.
They could go, you know, the getting anti-gay marriage
rights.
In both states. And
it's like
because,
the death penalty.
Yeah,
can
and because
have
of the
not.
Weird way the cases arrived at the Supreme Court, in both cases there are actually ways that the Supreme Court could decline to decide the cases because of the weird ways that the parties are lined up. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of technical Supreme Court geek stuff. It's actually quite interesting. But they may end up dismissing both cases and not deciding.
Doesn't seem to happen nearly as often as we were told in law school that did it. As a law student, I remember learning the Supreme Court always looks for the narrowest possible ground in which to decide something.
That's
and if there's – whenever it has an opportunity to not decide a big issue, it will avoid doing so. But lately, that restraint doesn't seem to be quite as strong as it used to be.
It certainly hasn't happened that way in the last couple of years.
So will there be a religious overtone to this? Will freedom of religion clause play into this, do you think, the gay marriage decision?
I don't really see why it would. No one is telling churches or synagogues or other religious institutions that they have to sanction certain kinds of marriages. No, that's not an issue in the case, and it would certainly be out of the question for that to happen. So as far as I can tell, there's no free exercise.
Well, nobody's going to say a priest must perform a same-sex
union. Of course
not. But that's not to say that there aren't very serious freedom of religion issues that are implicated in all of this. So, look at the this wasn't marriage exactly. This was gay adoption. But look what happened with Catholic Charities. Adoption in Massachusetts.
No, other cases could arise out of it. You're absolutely right. You know, paying benefits to married couples, that kind of thing. Does a religious institution that employs a same-sex married couple have to, have to pay benefits to the married partner, something like that. Those can come up, but they're not presented in this case.
All right. Talking to David Kravitz from Blue Mass Group and Jeff Jacoby, Boston Globe columnist. This is Politics as Usual. And what Politics as Usual Monday would be without our speculation segment? Speculation.
Isn't that what we've been doing?
I think so. So I can't believe that the president hasn't decided on the cabinet post yet. I thought he was going to do that last week. I mean, what's the holdup here? I know he's got the fiscal cliff, but he needs to make a move on replacement for Hillary Clinton and defense. Doesn't he? I mean, what's going to happen? It's going to have to be this week or next.
I don't know what he's going to do. I honestly don't. I don't know if he's going to – I mean, obviously he
– holding out for Susan Rice.
He wants hoping. Susan Rice.
It seems like an obstinate move at this point.
If he waits for the new Congress – and if the new Congress, if the new Senate changes the rules on filibusters, he may well get Susan Rice. Mm. And maybe that's
He'll certainly have a few more Democrats.
He has a couple more Democrats. But if the rules change, then he doesn't actually need 60 votes to get her confirmed.
I wish one of you guys would explain something to me. Why is it that everybody seems to take it for granted that Hillary Clinton is stepping down as Secretary of State because it's just been an exhausting job? But, 4 years is enough. And so she hasn't got the stamina to go on for another term as Secretary of State. And yet there's all this speculation about how she should run for president in 4 years.
I haven't heard that it's because she's exhausted.
I haven't either.
Four years is a long time to serve as Secretary of State. I don't know how many Secretary of States over the years have served for more than that. But I don't
sometimes
think
they've gone into a second term.
Cabinet posts are just for one term, or is it only that?
Not transportation or education where,
really
you got to get on a plane
ones.
And go to Boston from Washington. But going to the Middle East, 16 times a year. And it's like, oh, my God, just the travel alone. I mean, it's time consuming. You don't have a normal life, and I think most cabinet secretaries do. Even defense, you're not traveling that much. So I think it's just she's ready.
Do you guys see her as plausible presidential material 4 years from now?
Oh, no. I do. You don't, Mel? You don't, Emily?
Not really. No.
I don't think it's a gimme for her. Certainly, I think there are probably other Democrats who would like to run, and certainly there are Republicans who would who would like to run against her. But absolutely, I think she's an extremely plausible. I think if she is in.
Done herself a world of good the last 4 years.
Yeah, no, yeah, absolutely right. And I think she, you know,
Oh, stop.
Well, look at
she becomes the odds on favorite.
It doesn't exactly seem like the past 4 years have, you know, that what we're seeing is the fruits of a brilliantly successful foreign policy.
I don't know if
anybody
can solve the crisis in the Middle East, Jeff.
Everything else in the world.
Much as we try. All right, we've been talking politics as usual with Jeff Jacoby from the Boston Globe and David Kravitz from BlueMaths Group. That's going to do it for us this afternoon. My thanks to both of you.
Thanks so much, Emily. A lot of fun.
As always. And Edgar B. Herwick III is back. What do you got?
Hey, Emily. How's it going? Okay, so a little quick math question for you. If
I'm
a picture is worth 1,000 words, how many words are 500,000 pictures worth? It doesn't really matter.
5 trillion.
I think 500 million. So pretty close. But
that's not close.
The point is that I think a lot of people would call a particular collection of 500,000 photos that we're going to talk about priceless. It's the Sports Illustrated Archive, 58 years of sports history in photographs. We're going to talk to the guy who's in charge of it all.
Great. I'm Emily Rooney.
I'm Edgar B. Herwick III, and this is Boston Public Radio.